I'd like to thank the committee for this invitation to speak to you today, and I'd also like to take just a moment to thank my colleague Chuck Aaron, who has influenced my thinking on the catechisms far more than the single reference to his work in the text of this essay would indicate. The topic is the catechisms as a model for mission proclamation. Question: what do we call the book which we are about to study? Answer: we call this book the Catechism. Question: what is a catechism? Answer: a catechism is a book of instruction in the form of questions and answers. Question: who wrote our small catechism? Answer: Dr. Martin Luther wrote our small catechism. Those are the first three questions in the short explanation of the catechism that I, and probably most of you, used in grade school and confirmation class. Unfortunately, the impression given by these questions about the history and nature of the catechism is almost entirely false. The word catechism really refers to the substance of the book, the texts themselves, Ten Commandments, Creeds, Lord's Prayer, rather than to the form of questions and answers. It can also, for this reason, be misleading to say that Luther wrote the catechism rather than explanations to the catechism. As we shall see, Luther's catechisms intentionally followed the tradition of catechesis that went back through the Middle Ages to the early church. Luther did not invent the catechism. The idea that he did, however, has a long history. Ian Green suggests that 16th century Protestants purposely equated the word catechism with the idea of questions and answers, the form that they thought the early church had used, in order to credit Luther with a brand new revival of the practice of the early church. Now, as clear as it might be that Luther did not invent catechesis and that he wasn't even the first Lutheran to write a catechism, the prevalent definition of catechism has exerted an unhealthy influence on Lutheran thinking. This definition and the exclusive identification of Luther's name with the catechism has led to a parochial use of the catechism, and indeed a certain embarrassment in some quarters that this book, rather than the Bible, would be used as the basis for instruction. Thus, there might be a certain uneasiness with the topic of this presentation, the catechism as a model for mission proclamation. What does a text produced in 16th century Germany have to do with mission? The answer is quite a lot, if we understand the catechism for what it truly is, and if we understand what Luther himself intended it to do. For that reason, I would like to begin by discussing the catechisms in their historical context. So the first major division is the catechisms in context. Anyone who has bothered to read the preface to the large catechism knows the circumstances that led to its publication. It is not for trivial reasons, Luther wrote, that we constantly treat the catechism and exhort and implore others to do the same. For we see that unfortunately many preachers and pastors are very negligent in doing so, and thus despise both their office and this teaching. Some do it out of their great learnedness, while others do so out of pure laziness and concern for their bellies. They approach the task as if they were preachers for their stomach's sake and had nothing to do but live off the fat of the land, as they were used to doing under the papacy. Although Luther had preached on the catechism throughout the 1520s, he didn't publish this material until he was confronted with the first visitation reports in fall of 1528. What the visitors found in the Saxon parishes was indeed troubling. Not only the people, but their pastors were ignorant of the basics of the Christian faith, such as the commandments. In response, Luther launched as an all-out campaign what he had already expressed as a plan of attack in the German Mass of 1525, basic instruction in the Christian faith centered on the catechism. Protestant mythology aside, this was a remarkably conservative solution to the problem. Luther's catechism was, in fact, Catholic. What he laid out as the basis of instruction was the same collection of texts and topics that had been used in the early church and continued with some variation throughout the Middle Ages. From the 2nd to the 6th centuries, when the instruction of adult converts prior to baptism was the norm, the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer were invariably parts of catechesis. These texts were handed over to the converts either during Lent, prior to their baptism at the vigil of Easter, or after their baptism during the Easter season. This tradition of instruction had to change when those being baptized were no longer adults, but infants. By the 6th century, the handing over of the text was retained, but now involved the sponsors as representatives of the child, even though these godparents themselves were often ignorant of the prayers. For this reason, bishops like Caesarius of Arles vigorously promoted the teaching of Lord's Prayer and Creed and other texts to all Christians. As that example indicates, many bishops recognized the very real catechetical deficiencies in their churches, and they even succeeded in making catechesis a topic of imperial reform legislation during the reign of Charlemagne. The problem they faced can be illustrated from a description of the baptism rite as practiced just before Charlemagne's time. This is from the Gelasian Sacramentary. The form of the baptism service remains relatively unchanged from the early church, but now parents and godparents speak for the infant. For that reason, the handing over of the creed and the Lord's Prayer to the person being baptized is largely form without substance. In fact, the rite seems to indicate that by this time, when the word catechize was used in relation to baptism, people really understood it in the sense of exercise. So the brief exposition connected with handing over the Lord's Prayer and Creed was probably directed toward the godparents, since most Christians continued to be found wanting in their knowledge of these texts. Charlemagne himself told a story about how he was at worship, and he asked two people who were standing by waiting to be godparents in the baptismal rite whether they knew the Creed and the Lord's Prayer. They told him they did not. And the ruler at that point would not allow them to be godparents until they knew those texts. And furthermore, and you can imagine the trepidation of the clergy here, he ordered the bishop to call the priest together to find out why their catechesis wasn't working better. What that incident and others like it shows is the difficulty inherent in the process of Christianization. That is, forming and teaching the nominal and often half-hearted Christians who had come into the church through social pressure or mass conversion. It's against such a background that the Carolingian reform legislation has to be read. Throughout the 9th century, bishops were instructed by various synods and assemblies to study the faith themselves, to instruct their clergy, and to preach to the people. The preachers were to have collections of sermons to help them in this task, and, as we find in specific canons of these councils, they were to address their audiences in the vernacular. The myth that people in the Middle Ages would speak to the laity in Latin is just that, a myth. Behind all of these regulations related to preaching was this need for basic instruction, for catechesis. People needed to have a knowledge of the texts of the Christian faith. What is clear is that by the early Middle Ages, what had been instruction related to baptism was now general instruction for all Christians. Catechesis, defined as instruction based on the Creed, Lord's Prayer, and then the Virtues and Vices, or Ten Commandments, and possibly other texts, was directed toward all members of the church. So that, as one historian has noted, even the most ill-equipped priest of all was expected to give his outline instruction to the parish four times annually on Pater Noster, Ave, Creed, Commandments, Vices and Virtues, and the rest. In addition to that preaching, confession often became an opportunity for catechesis, especially, as you might imagine, with regard to the virtues and vices or the commandments. This catechesis was extremely basic and practical. The first element was simply to teach people to recite the basic texts of the Christian faith. In a society that was basically illiterate, that in itself was no mean task. And it was certainly not mere child's play. Even though a synod of Dublin in the 12th century required priests to catechize children, another historian has noted, quote, any kind of systematic instruction for children must have been the rare exception before the Council of Trent. Catechesis was usually part of the school curriculum. Indeed, Martin Luther, for that reason, credited these schools with preserving the church, but only a very few ever attended school. Instead, throughout the Middle Ages, catechetical instruction was delivered to Christians of all ages through the practice of confession and through preaching. In spite of the efforts of many in the church to teach the people, in spite of the idea that Christendom was coterminous with the West, Europe remained a mission field. The situation was little better at the end of the Middle Ages than it had been at the beginning. The people, and especially those in rural areas, who stared up at the pulpit in church listening to the priest's instruction, were in many ways still pagans. And Luther himself often referred to them as such. It is clear that the transaction between the church and Germanic tribes in late antiquity and the early Middle Ages had not been one way. Instead, the medieval church was transformed in significant ways as it attempted to Christianize these peoples. What that meant for the Middle Ages, and especially for our topic, is this. The people's faith consisted of a magical worldview with a healthy dose of superstition overlaid with a veneer of Christianity. Although, as we have seen, there were attempts at continuing catechesis, the church also responded to this problem with the idea of implicit faith. It was enough for people to say they believed what the church believed. For that reason, among others, it's even been suggested that the process of Christianization begun in late antiquity was not completed until the 16th century, with the Protestant Reformation and the Council of Trent. Which brings me to the second main division, Luther's catechisms in the mission field of his day. Although it's easy to oversimplify, the situation in the late Middle Ages was grave, and churchmen who took their office seriously recognized it. Thus, Luther was not necessarily exaggerating when he spoke of those who were not yet Christians, who during church services, quote, stand around and gape, hoping to see something new, just as if we were holding a service among the Turks or the heathen in a public square or out in a field. In fact, Luther looked at his congregation in Wittenberg and others in Saxony as a mission field. Though all the people had been baptized and were nominally Christian, Luther doubted that many were really Christians, that is, that they understood and believed anything of the faith. His response was to renew the catechesis that had characterized the church for almost 1,000 years. Given that fact, we must ask, what made Luther's renewal and his explanation of the catechism the driving force it became in the 16th century? I'd like to suggest three reasons that are also helpful in understanding the catechisms as models for mission proclamation today. First, Luther's explanations were based on his understanding of faith. Second, his explanations articulated the Christian faith in a concrete and understandable way. Third, the catechism was versatile in its use and in its manner of delivery. Luther's renewed understanding of faith sounds throughout the simple explanations to the text of the catechism. As Catholic as it was in form, Luther's catechism differed radically from its medieval predecessors in content. I've already mentioned how in the Middle Ages catechesis often took place during confession. It worked the other way around as well, that confession had this impact on catechesis. The catechesis was often then geared toward the practice of confession. People were taught what they needed to know in order to make a good confession. But even where confession wasn't in view, medieval catechesis focused overwhelmingly on behavior, the good works appropriate to the Christian. By contrast, Luther explained even the commandments from the standpoint of faith. We should fear and love God. the refrain that begins the explanation of each commandment in the small catechism, places that commandment in the context of a faith relationship between God and the believer. We can find similar contrasts in explanations of the creed. Jean Gerson, one of the most ardent proponents of catechesis in the late Middle Ages, authored several catechetical treatises in French for the instruction of the laity. In his explanation of how God redeemed us, loosely based on the creed, Gerson explained that Christ, quote, preached for about 3 years and performed countless miracles and gave us the Christian law written in the four Gospels and ordained the seven sacraments, namely baptism, confirmation, the sacrament of the altar, penance, holy orders, marriage, and last unction. End of quote. Now, in all fairness to Gerson, he also did mention Christ's death and resurrection. But it's not at all clear how this benefited the individual believer. Contrast that with Luther's declaration, again from the Small Catechism, that Christ has redeemed me, a lost and condemned human being. He has purchased and freed me from all sins, from death, and from the power of the devil, not with gold or silver, but with his holy precious blood and with his innocent suffering and death. This for us aspect of faith continues in Luther's treatment of the Lord's Prayer and in his explanation of the sacraments. In the Lord's Prayer, Luther shows how the believer seeks to have God and God's gifts. In the sacraments, he emphasizes, again in contrast to medieval teaching, how faith is necessary to receive the benefits of baptism and the Lord's Supper. Furthermore, Luther was willing to put the biblical texts concerning the sacraments into the hands of the people so that they could see for themselves what Christ had said about the sacraments he instituted. The medieval church, on the other hand, approached any written translation of the Bible with extreme trepidation and certainly never trusted the laity to read such texts for themselves. Luther's understanding of faith made this not only desirable but necessary. Yet Luther's idea of faith in itself does not entirely explain the success of his catechisms. Many other Lutherans authored catechisms that, in spite of their orthodox content, failed to thrive as Luther's did. Thus, the second point here is that Luther explained life by faith in concrete and understandable language. Because the large catechism is based on Luther's sermons on the catechism, its language is vivid and immediate. So, for example, Luther describes the work of the Holy Spirit in the third article of the Creed by saying, "He first leads us into his holy community, placing us in the church's lap, where he preaches to us and brings us to Christ." Luther showed a similar mastery of concrete expression in identifying the sins of his congregation against the Ten Commandments. In explaining the seventh commandment, for example, Luther described the sort of theft that was all too common among his flock. He wrote, "At the market and in everyday business, the same fraud prevails in full power and force. One person openly cheats another with defective merchandise, false weights and measures, and counterfeit coins, and takes advantage of the other by deception and sharp practices and crafty dealings. Or again, one swindles another in a trade and deliberately fleeces, skins, and torments him. Who can even describe or imagine it all? In short, thievery is the most common craft and the largest guild on earth. If we look at the whole world in all its situations, it is nothing but a big, wide stable full of great thieves." In addition to that sort of concrete language, which could at times be extremely entertaining, Luther made the catechism understandable by drawing attention to its structure. When he introduced the creed in the large catechism, he pointed out its relation to the Ten Commandments. He said, "Thus far we have heard the first part of Christian teaching, and in it we have seen all that God wishes us to do and not to do. The creed properly follows, which sets forth all that we must expect and receive from God. In short, it teaches us to know him perfectly. It is given in order to help us do what the Ten Commandments require of us. For as we have said above, they are set so high that all human ability is far too puny and weak to keep them. Therefore, it is just as necessary to learn this part as it is the other, so that we may know where and how to obtain the power to do this. If we were able, by our own strength, to keep the Ten Commandments as they ought to be kept, we would need nothing else, neither the Creed nor the Lord's Prayer. Then, when Luther moved on to introduce the Lord's Prayer, he wrote, "We have now heard what we are to do and believe. The best and most blessed life consists of these things. Now follows the third part, how we are to pray. We are in such a situation that no one can keep the Ten Commandments perfectly, even though he or she has begun to believe. Besides, the devil, along with the world and our flesh, resists them with all his power. Consequently, nothing is so necessary as to call upon God incessantly and to drum into his ears our prayer that he may give, preserve, and increase in us faith and the fulfillment of the Ten Commandments and remove all that stands in our way and hinders us in this regard." Similarly, in baptism, absolution, and the Lord's Supper, Luther shows how these are gospel and nourish the life of faith. Luther's structure might be described as a simple move from law, the Ten Commandments, to gospel, the Creed and the Lord's Prayer and the sacraments, and then into Christian vocation, represented by the Table of Duties in the Small Catechism. Yet as Luther himself points out in the Large Catechism, the movement is not one way through these parts. Instead, the Christian life consists of a constant interaction between the realities described in each of the chief parts. For this reason, Charles Arendt has said the chief parts of the Catechism establish a law and gospel rhythm for the Christian life. One important relationship that Luther himself underscored was that between the first commandment and the first article of the Creed. Following this relationship through yields a Trinitarian framework to the Catechism, in which all of the commandments form a unit with the first article. The second article stands alone as the transition between the first article and the third unit, which is made up of the third article in the Lord's Prayer. In this way, the whole of the Catechism is related to the work of the Father, Son, and Spirit. Christians experience this work as law, gospel, and new life, which is lived out in vocation. It's a sequence that may not be immediately apparent, but would emerge naturally as the Catechism was applied to daily life. In addition to this overall structure, there is a structure within each part of the Catechism that aids in remembering its contents. In the Large Catechism, Luther treats each sacrament under three headings: what it is, what its benefits are, and who is to receive it. That same structure can be seen in the section on baptism and the section on the Lord's Supper in the Small Catechism. In that work, the commandments and the Creed are further examples of repetition and rhythm within each part that are meant for hearing and speaking. I've already mentioned how each of the commandments references the first one with the phrase, "We should fear and love God." In the Creed, the explanation of each article begins appropriately enough with the words, "I believe," and concludes with the familiar, "This is most certainly true." Those are phrases that stick in a person's mind. And that's why you might be a Lutheran if your knee-jerk response to any correct observation is, "This is most certainly true." In spite of what he had done in the catechisms, Luther still faced the problem that had proved practically insurmountable in the Middle Ages. How can the average layperson be taught the catechism? The answer is in the third point of the discussion, that Luther's catechisms were extremely versatile in their use and in their manner of delivery. In some ways, Luther's vision for his catechisms was completely traditional. The catechism was to be taught in the home by the head of the household, in the church by the pastor, and in school. Even the focus on parents as primary teachers of the catechism was not a new emphasis. We've already seen that the medieval church expected godparents to play a role in catechesis. Parents, too, were expected to teach their children. A late 15th century work instructed a mother this way: "Christian mother, as you hold your child made in God's image on your lap, make the sign of the Holy Cross on his brow, on his mouth, and on his breast. And as soon as he is able to speak, pray with him so that he can pray with you, that is, repeat the words that you have uttered. You should bless your child, instruct him in the faith, and prepare him at an early age for confession." If the focus on parents was not novel, neither was expecting pastors to preach and teach the catechism. But what Luther did was to provide a fundamental but flexible body of material that might serve these various catechetical needs. In the small catechism, he presented the most basic teaching in a way that could be committed to memory. In the large catechism, he gave a fuller explanation that, because it had been a series of sermons, could be preached directly to a congregation. But the books were capable of far more than that. Either might also be read for private instruction and edification. The genius of the two books is attested by the fact that the Jesuit Peter Canisius copied the form to provide Catholic catechisms for Counter-Reformation Germany. Perhaps more revolutionary, indeed more revolutionary than the channels for delivery, was Luther's use of the latest technology and ideas about education to enhance that delivery. So much has been written on the importance of printing for the Reformation that I need mention it only briefly here. The catechisms were indeed printed, and thus they were able to reach a much larger audience than any similar medieval work might have reached. The two books also took advantage of increasing literacy, though it should be remembered that most people still could not read. That too would change, especially since education for children was a goal of both Renaissance humanists and reformers like Luther. Luther rebelled against the kind of education he himself had received and encouraged teachers to think like children in order to teach them. Finally, Luther's reform of education at Wittenberg, based largely on humanist ideas about education, addressed deficiencies in the preparation of pastors. In other words, Luther planned eventually to replace the kind of pastors he complained about in the preface to the Large Catechism. In addition, and this is my final point in this section, Luther's catechisms could be put to multiple uses because they steered a course between two potential misunderstandings about the function of the catechism. The first we've already identified as the medieval tendency to focus exclusively on behavior, gearing the catechism to confession and proper obedience. If that problem is easily avoided by Lutherans, the second seems endemic to Luther's heirs. That is, to use the catechism as nothing more than a book of instruction. We have only to look at our small catechism to find confirmation of this tendency. The explanation to the small catechism, the section of questions and answers based on Luther's catechism, is more than 6 times longer than the catechism itself. This explanation does nothing less than turn the catechism into a miniature dogmatics text. Luther himself, by contrast, emphasized throughout his life the devotional use of the catechism. He wrote a well-known treatise about how to pray the catechism for his barber, Peter. Luther also stated on several occasions that he himself used the catechism regularly in prayer. In the preface to the Large Catechism, he wrote, "I am also a doctor and a preacher, just as learned and experienced as all of them who are so high and mighty. Nevertheless, each morning and whatever else I have time, I do as a child who is being taught the catechism, and I read and recite word for word the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Psalms, and the like. I must still read and study the catechism daily, and yet I cannot master it as I wish, but must remain a child and pupil of the catechism, and I also do so gladly." Which brings me to the third part of the presentation, the catechisms as model for mission proclamation today. If we do not think of the catechisms as a resource and model for mission proclamation, it is perhaps only because we have lost touch with their origin and purpose. The catechism itself presents basic biblical and creedal texts with a long history of forming Christians in faith and life. Using the catechism marks us as Catholic in the best sense of the word and reminds us that the gospel we preach is not an invention of the 16th century. Furthermore, as we have seen, Luther had a mission audience in view as he wrote his explanations. The people he addressed were often only nominally Christian, and in their personal beliefs were subject to some profoundly non-Christian influences. In other words, whatever we may have been led to believe, it was not all that different from the situation we face today. With that in mind, I'd like to revisit the three points I've made about Luther's catechisms and suggest some general applications for our mission proclamation today. First, the catechisms present in basic form a profound understanding of the Christian faith. Considered in this way, the catechisms help to shape the message of mission proclamation. In a world where people are searching for meaning and identity, the catechisms present a set of meaningful relationships. Most important, of course, is the relationship between God and the believer. But the catechisms also explain the relationships believers have with one another in the church, the relationships they have by virtue of vocation, their relationship with others as governed by the Ten Commandments, even their relationship with creation, considered under the first article. Luther's explanations of these relationships rest on a deep understanding of the gospel and of human nature. In his introduction to the Lord's Prayer and the Large Catechism, for example, Luther observed, "The human heart is by nature so desperately wicked that it always flees from God." Yet Luther could add to that observation in the Small Catechism explanation to the third article, "But the Holy Spirit has called me by the gospel." Second, the catechisms are concrete and understandable. Here we might discuss the language of mission proclamation, not just the translation of individual words, but the structure of communication. There's been a great deal of discussion about the time-bound nature of Luther's explanations. We all remember the explanation to the first article of the Creed that God has given me my fields, cattle, and all my goods. As a junior high confirmand, none of us had fields and cattle yet. The Large Catechism, of course, has even more specific references to life in early 16th century Germany. But this shouldn't blind us to the continuing value of Luther's words of explanation. A Finnish missionary to Kenya told the story of how he presented a new Swahili translation of the Small Catechism. After he had spoken about this for a while and he was finished, a man came up to him who was visibly agitated. The man began to tell the missionary how angry he was about the catechism. Thinking that he didn't like the book, the missionary asked him what was wrong with it. "Well, nothing," the man answered. "I'm angry because we've had missionaries here for 100 years and no one has given us this book before." The catechism is capable of being understood across cultures and in spite of some of its language. In fact, you could even say that the archaisms in Luther's text help point out the value of his approach and of the catechetical texts themselves. Because the Ten Commandments, Creed, and Lord's Prayer apply immediately to the life of the Christian, they are capable of the sort of specific application that Luther employed. Indeed, they demand it. More often than not, behind Luther's outdated example is a basic principle that is still very applicable today. These principles can guide us as we apply the catechisms to the specifics of 21st century life. Perhaps the most important of these principles is the structure of law, gospel, and new life as it is revealed from the text. Clearly, we ought to take this overall structure seriously as we continue to translate the message of the catechetical text for our use today. What we must not do is let the difficulties of translation keep us from placing these texts at the center of Christian proclamation and education. They have a power to sustain and direct faith and life that cannot be matched by evangelism and education materials that attempt to offer a quick overview of all aspects of theology. For that reason, we must take advantage of the third point, that the catechisms are versatile in their use and in their manner of delivery. This point addresses the method of mission proclamation. We often fail to use Luther's catechisms to their full potential. They've been equated with junior high confirmation, and only sporadically have they been put to other use. We've been too influenced by the idea that they are basic introductions to theology to be abandoned once basic instruction has been completed. Perhaps we've even been embarrassed by the erroneous notion that teaching the catechism in home, church, and school is unique to Lutheranism, and therefore to be left behind as we try to reach out in mission. Here it's important to distinguish the elements that constitute what we mean by catechism. Traditionally, our use of the term embraces the catechetical texts, Luther's explanations, and quite often additional explanations, explanations of the explanations, as it were. Thus, it may be helpful for a moment to think about a reductionistic catechism. Looking only at the text, which have always been a part of the Christian faith and Christian formation and identity, we should have numerous ideas about how they might be used in forming and serving mission proclamation. First, understanding the catechisms and their history might cause us to rethink our understanding of what mission proclamation is. As in Luther's day, the border between church and mission today is often not as well defined as we would like it to be. In our society, general knowledge of Christian teaching has declined dramatically. I remember once, a number of years ago, standing in a gallery in the Art Institute of Chicago. The room was dominated by an altarpiece depicting the crucifixion. And as I was looking at it, a young girl and her father walked up and began to look at this painting too. The girl looked at it, pointed to Jesus, and said, "Daddy, who is that?" Incidents like that should, I believe, encourage us to think about mission proclamation in the widest sense. Luther could not assume, and we should not assume, that we're always preaching to people who are more than nominally Christian. With that in mind, we should clearly assume nothing about what the people we meet on the street know about the Christian faith. We need to get back to the basics. The people you encounter on evangelism visits may not know the Lord's Prayer, and they might be very interested in the basic explanation of the Trinity contained in the Apostles' Creed. The second point here is that the different uses to which the catechisms can be put recommend their use in evangelism, instruction, and assimilation. The catechism should certainly be used in adult instruction because the catechetical texts simply need to be placed in the hands of Christians. Again, I would say here the point is not to give an introduction to all of systematic theology. What the catechisms do is even more important than that. They lay the foundation for faith and provide the means for growth in the life of faith. In addition, when so many parents are coming into churches for the sake of their children, the catechism provides valuable resources for spiritual life in the home. The message of the catechisms can be continually reinforced in the life of the church, and this is where assimilation and education come into view, especially in preaching. In spite of the fact that for centuries the catechism was taught from the pulpit, catechetical preaching seems to have fallen on hard times. Yet a congregation formed by and rooted in the catechism would indeed provide a powerful witness to its community. Finally, mission proclamation is served by the various methods of delivery of which the catechisms are capable. Remember that Luther embraced the printing technology of his day to serve catechesis, but he also kept the old. Like his medieval predecessors, he understood that pictures as well as words served the message. And to that end, the small catechism was published with numerous woodcut illustrations accompanying the text. What catechesis in the new century will look like is anybody's guess. Certainly, we should take advantage of the opportunities offered by computer, internet, video, and all the rest. The specifics of that use will and should vary from one situation to the next. But we shouldn't entirely abandon the tried and true either. In my experience, I found it very helpful to have the pocket-sized paperback editions of the catechism without all the additional explanations in the back. The Catechism is certainly capable of sustaining a wide variety of formats and many varied uses. Most importantly, these should serve the mission of the Church, the proclamation of the gospel message that Jesus Christ has won forgiveness for us and offers that forgiveness to us fully and freely each day. The Catechism should stand at the center of the life lived in the gospel, the life of faith that Luther worked to portray in his explanations. That is possible because the Catechism is more, much more, than a book of instruction in the form of questions and answers. Thank you.
We have time for questions and answers.
Paul Dave Wollenberg from the seminary. Just a comment, really, not a question. Several years ago when I was a pastor here in St. Louis, a lady showed up in my office one day and said, "How do I join the church?" And I said, "Why? What do you know?" And she reached in her purse and pulled out a copy of Schwann's Catechism. I said, "Where did you get that?" She bought it at a yard sale, read it, and by the time we got done, she was ready to be baptized and confirmed. It works.
I like what you said there at the very end. And I was wondering, with maybe a CPH representative here, what kind of a form could a catechism take, or should it take, that would include diagrams, pictures, illustrations, so that it would be a real tool and whatever?
We happen to have a representative of CPH who's willing to field that question.
The best place to have the catechism is in here and in here, but in terms of printed version, one of the things I think that we did the best was to include the catechism on page 300 of our Lutheran hymnal. I know as a pastor in the pulpit, I would frequently make use of the catechism from the pulpit. It was so easy to turn there and for me to ask the question and have everybody read the response. And that doing that on a continuing basis would help to drill and continue to get that into the head and into the heart. I think the woodcuts and illustrations and so forth that were included in the recent Kolb Wengert edition are very, very helpful, and perhaps we could think about including those in the new hymnal that we'll be working on for CPH. But an excellent question, and thank you very much.
Jim Brower, Concordia Seminary. For some time, I worked at Synod headquarters, and there was much talk about mission, so I have a somewhat simple question. If it's too simple, would you comment? In a culture that often talks about Christianity spread as being the moment of conversion, and those numbers then being important in the church, are you telling me that the understanding of how to live a life of faith, as the Catechism explains it, is part of what we do when we fill the Great Commission? For example, that phrase, teaching all things that I've commanded you? Well, is that what you're telling me?
It seems to me that there is a parallel between the situation that Luther faced, where by current definitions, everybody in Saxony was a Christian. Luther looked at them with his understanding of what a Christian was, and he had extreme doubts about that. And I'm suggesting that maybe we just assume too much about the people that come in and come through our adult instruction in terms of the background they have, what they really understand of the faith. And so I think maybe here Luther's model is helpful too, that you simply work with those people as they sit in the church on Sunday morning, and everybody gets a continuing dose of catechesis as you go through it.
Just a few examples from my Philippine experience. When I arrived in the Philippines in 1955, I was assigned to the southern island of Mindanao, and that's where the Cebuano language is used. And my first job while learning the Cebuano language was to work with some of our laymen in translating the catechism into Cebuano. Later, when I was studying for my PhD here, Could Cordia Seminary recognize that as my foreign language production? So, but then the next thing we did was in the 1960s, we organized the National Lutheran Church, and our confessional basis, we didn't feel we could adopt the whole Formula of Concord because our Filipino members didn't know that. So we did adopt the Small Catechism and the Augsburg Confession, and we got busy translating that in the, at least the major languages of the Philippines. Then in, I shared with Chuck Aran, in 20 years of broadcasting over 8 radio stations to the Muslims of the southern Philippines, I have used the whole Small Catechism and explained it to the Muslims.
Herbert Birch, evangelistic missionary to Guatemala. Today in Guatemala and in all of Central America, the Small Catechism has been converted into 3 folders that are self-instructional, and there are 14 lessons. And you go through the entire Small Catechism basically in these 3 booklets, answer the questions at the back, send them into Christ for All the Nations, which is the outreach arm of the Lutheran Layman's League, and then you get credit for it. Oddly enough, the Pentecostals and many other Christian groups in Guatemala are using this with better success than a lot of our national pastors to instruct their people in the Christian faith.
Thank you again.